you and I have always talked about this, and I think a lot of other folks who listen to this and who are music lovers can agree. If you really love that band, you can be critical of them because you love them, not just because you're trying to pick them apart or whatnot.
Hello and welcome to the Ear Fuel Podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at The Daily Guru and at Get Ear Fuel. The podcast is available in the iTunes Store under Ear Fuel and also at soundcloud.com/Get Ear Fuel. What you heard at the top was part of my conversation with Christian, who is one of my oldest friends and fellow music obsessives, and he and I talked about Record Store Day, band reunions, Metallica, and tons more the other week when I was back home in Ohio. We will get to that, though, right after a quick album review. Today I want to check out the brand new album from Iggy Pop, and it's called Post-Pop Depression. Now, this is his first record since 2012, and many people, myself included, were excited for this because his main collaborator for this album was multi-instrumentalist Josh Homme, who you know from both Queens of the Stone Age and Eagles of Death Metal. Not only does Homme play a ton of instruments on this album, but he was the sole producer, he had a lot of writing going on here, he was heavily involved. This was a collaboration in the truest possible sense of the word. Rounding out the band is Dean from Queens of the Stone Age and Matt from Arctic Monkeys, and with that level of talent heading into the studio basically in secret, with Iggy at the helm, well, my expectations were extremely high for this record, and on many levels, they delivered. The album's opening track, Break Into Your Heart, is nothing short of magnificent. While we all love Iggy flying off the rails like he did in the Stooges' days, there's something to be said for when the man keeps things a bit more restrained like he does on this song. There's a strong sense of theater on the track, and he seems to be channeling his inner Nick Cave, though, let's be honest, Nick channeled a lot of Iggy in his time, but there's just something in Iggy's vocals throughout it that kept Nick Cave in my head. I don't know. It makes sense to me, and I think it will for you, too, when you hear it. This opening song, like many of the songs on the album, it has a ton of space around it, and there's this vibe to it that almost makes it feel like a really good jam session or maybe even a rehearsal for the band. It feels really raw, and it's a very good thing. There's this dark, often smoky groove that runs through the vast majority of the record, and it manifests itself in different ways, but it's there, and that's what really keeps this record cohesive. And that singular sound, I mean, it has this heaviness to it, and I think that's where the tones of the depression in Post-Pop Depression come through. It's like a dejected march in some ways, I think I want to say. Now, let's be clear here, though. Iggy has said that this record is all about having to deal with the end of your creative career and sort of looking back on your legacy, and you can pick up on that both musically and lyrically, and he makes it very clear when he outright says, "I'm nothing but my name." It's a really, really interesting thought, but this is by no means a swan song for him, I hope. Because the collaboration and the songwriting and Iggy's voice, it's really damn good. Whether it's the shimmer of a song like Gardenia or the thumping groove on Sunday, you can really feel the band pulsing as a single unit. This is what creativity is all about. Everybody is all in, and the end product is far greater than the sum of its parts. That being said, this record does overstay its welcome, which, I hate to say it, it's something Iggy has been very guilty of over the last decade or so, regardless of the project he's working on. I hate to say it, but it's true. There are a few tracks here that just don't compare to the rest, and I think the album would have been stronger without them. A few songs sound too similar, and I unfortunately found myself losing interest here and there. In an era when EPs or even 7-song albums are more than acceptable, they could have had a stellar home run if they'd really taken some time and trimmed the fat. Overall, though, there is a ton to love on this album for longtime fans as well as newcomers to the Iggy Pop universe. His vocals are fresh and strong, and his backing band are more than up to the task of supporting the true king of rock and roll. Iggy Pop is the true king of rock and roll. As I see it, if you want to hear a solid record that will give you at least 2 songs to put into heavy rotation, do yourself a favor, check out Post-Pop Depression. Moving on. So I was back in Ohio the other week, and I spent the day with a fellow music fanatic. For more than a decade, my buddy Christian and I have passed more music back and forth than I can count, along with seeing live shows all over the country from every genre possible. Before the man settled down to his lovely wife and family, he was a roadie for 311, G Love and Special Sauce, and others, so the man certainly knows his way around the music industry. we ended up just kind of sitting down and letting the conversation flow without any idea of whether or not we would have anything usable, and it ended up going in a number of unexpected directions that are really, really good. So without further ado, two music fans in conversation on a Saturday night. So we both love Metallica. Now, granted, you love post-Jason Newsted Metallica. I am not so much a fan. You know, Newsted, the end of Newsted is kind of the end of Metallica for
Let's
me.
Maybe qualify okay. Love.
You actually listened to it.
Yes. With many other fans.
Love is a strong word.
Yes.
It's a strong word.
The Saint Anger album, I wanted to like, because it's Metallica and I wanted to get behind it.
Uh-huh.
But with so many other folks, whatever was going through their heads of let's try to make this as lo-fi, let's try to get back to quote-unquote whatever roots are. I don't know what roots you had
that sure.
You wanted your record to sound like crap, but it was not.
Bloody Roots.
Yes. Sepultura. Now, I do believe, though, that the Death Magnetic was a step in the right direction,
mm-hmm.
and I really enjoy the album, and I like what Robert brings to the band, but I haven't got to the Love yet. I'm there with I really like Death Magnetic, and I know that they're working on new stuff, and we'll see where this goes.
Because, you know, a lot of people like to... I guess we're going to talk about Metallica for a bit, okay. Which is fine. You know, a lot of people like to say, oh, you don't like Metallica. You must have hated Load and Reload, like that I fell off of Load and Reload. Two records I thoroughly enjoy. I don't get why so many people shit on those albums.
They're underappreciated, and if you want to talk about... Metallica experimenting. Well, if you go back mm-hmm. to Ride the Lightning,
yeah,
if you think
exactly.
about to the acoustic guitars that they brought in there, and was there a fuss raised? Yeah, hardcore fans raised a fuss.
Right, but is anybody going to get on their case about like the opening to Battery? That's like, you know, the slow build and all of this. No, because it's fucking gorgeous.
Right, right, right. But with Load and Reload, again, they were, and I appreciate. That they were trying to do some things a little bit differently because, again, if there's some bands that can have the same formula over and over and I can be okay with, but with them, I'm glad that they tried to take a step in a different direction and tried some different things. But, again, for whatever reason, some hardcore fans are like, nope, it's not this. I can't get behind that.
And I enjoyed those records. I thought they were really good. Now, granted, when they put out S&M, I was done. I swore that band off because that, to me, was just such a money grub, no integrity move for them. It made me so mad. But I digress. What's your favorite Metallica album?
Master Puppets.
Okay. And what's your favorite Metallica song? Oh, this is hard.
Oh, God.
You only get to choose one.
You can destroy.
Okay. Because you know me. You know I am a hardcore Kill 'Em All fan.
Mm-hmm.
I worship at the altar of that record.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, though, Sanitarium, Welcome Home Sanitarium, is my all-time favorite Metallica song.
Huh. Our favorite albums and songs.
Yeah.
Are...
It's just reversed. Yeah. Although okay. I had the other week, I just could not get enough of Jump in the Fire. Like, I must have listened to that like 20 times in a row. It's just kind of one of those moods where you're just like, ugh.
If Seek and Destroy might, for whatever reason, I go back to Whiplash. If I
sure.
need something that I need to pound my fist against the dashboard, if I had a bad day at work, I gravitate to Whiplash for some reason.
The live shit binge and purge version of Seek and Destroy is ridiculous.
Yes.
Like,
for whatever reason, I can get behind that song, and it makes me smile for whatever. I don't know. I can, even though I was not there, I can just imagine I was. It, for whatever reason, it can really transport you to how they made the crowd feel at that time, mm-hmm. and you can, you can be a part of it.
They did so well all across the Binge and Purge records of doing exactly that. Like, you were in Mexico City. You can feel the energy on every single song. It's so cool. But let's actually get back to the point of why we brought up Metallica.
Yes, okay.
They were announced the other day that they're going to be the official ambassadors this year for Record Store Day. How did that sit with you?
The past few years, they've really tried to get those big stars in carrying the Record Store Day flag.
Yeah, it was Dave Grohl last year, right?
You're right. So with so many other things, and I've read a few articles on this where Record Store Day, again, as so many other movements in other areas, non-music or record store related, it started out as a really great idea. Let's have one day, let's have a special release.
Sure.
And let's really bring some things out of the archive and whatnot. But now it's got to where Record Store Day has, they want to have special releases, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at least, is it once a month that they want to do it? Or
every week at some point? They're trying to really make it a much more regular thing.
That's not what makes it special. And, you know, reel it back to the, you know, in April and then on Black Friday or whatever. Leave it once or twice a year. Leave it special. But I'm glad that they're trying to get those big names behind it. And again, is there some money behind it? Well, sure. But I also think that if they really weren't, I'm interested to see where they're going to take it. Because whereas so many other forms of music is good on vinyl, metal and metal lovers, how does that really translate to
being, I
want to really hear Kill 'Em All on vinyl. Does that really give a better sound? You know? So
as it skips a million times because you're thrashing around the room.
Right, exactly. So while I'm glad they're there, I'm interested to see what they're going to bring to the table, because are they going to bring some unreleased stuff out of the vaults to release?
Didn't they do a big Record Store Day release? Was it last year that they did it, or 2 years ago? Was it? I think it was called No Life to Leather. I mean, I know that's the lyric.
It was a
cassette?
The cassette release, yeah. I did not pick it up, unfortunately, but let me see something like that. You know, let me see some released, unreleased shows from their anniversary at the Fillmore. Let's see something like that. But don't just come there and say, you know, we're supporting Record Store Day. Give me some substance behind that.
So in your opinion, because, you know, you and I are both music fans and vinyl lovers and all that stuff, do you feel that this this move to bring in bigger names is diluting what Record Store was all about? Because my impression was that it was about getting people into their local record stores and, you know, checking out what the record stores have to offer. And now it's all of these massive bands, you know, the Becks, the Foo Fighters of the world, you know, putting out this limited edition thing so that, I'm going for the elitist statement. So that people who don't go to record stores on a random Saturday afternoon are going there that one day a year just to get that super exclusive item.
I've seen it because I've been there waiting in line on those days. And for me, it was almost a gateway drug into really getting into the record collecting, record buying experience. Mm-hmm. So for me, I see this and I see, oh, there's a limited release of, you know, 3,000 copies of the such and such, whatever it is, by Metallica this year. Great. I'm going to go there and I'm going to go into the store and realize there's all this used vinyl. Mm-hmm. There's a unique German pressing from the 70s of
a record that I already have 7 copies of, but I don't have the German copy, so I need it.
Which has a different outtake of, sure, you know, of whatever song it is.
Right.
So I'm going to get, and once you get hooked into that, then yes, I'm going to keep coming back for more. And that's what kind of happened to me. I was a very, I had very few records, and I had them for art. I had them hanging up on the wall.
Sure.
I didn't have them to listen to because I was still stuck in the CD era of listening to music.
Yeah.
And then once I saw the Record Store Day, I'm going to go check it out and see what it's all about. I got into the used vinyl. I got into the new stuff. And I got into, I think, at least for me, I want to listen to vinyl. And no matter what, you have arguments on both sides of the coin, but there is something about sitting down, turning off everything else around you, and listening to a record.
Absolutely.
And hearing those little crackles and pops and just, you know, just being surrounded
by that.
It's
the ritual of listening to vinyl.
It is. And in my house, we use records to listen to, but I also have albums on the wall as artwork. I can't do that with a CD or an MP3 or whatnot. It doesn't have that look. It doesn't have that feel.
And so I on that exact thought, because your daughter is 8 now, and I recall long ago you saying that, you know, she already had a record. You got an Alvin and the Chipmunks record, I believe. So does she know how to use your iPod?
She knows how to use the iPod and the iPad, and she also knows how to flip records and hold them correctly when she
wants
to.
But you guys go record shopping together from time to time.
Yes.
And she will find some thoroughly weird can I buy this?
Yes, she will buy a Disney Let's March record, and it has the characters singing about. But again, it's the cover, it's the artwork, uh-huh. It draws you in. What is this about? Oh, this looks great.
Yeah.
And then it goes to other things. For whatever reason, we went to the record store a few weeks ago, and she is really behind, I don't know why, she really loves Survivor's Eye of the Tiger right now.
Okay.
Daddy, do you think we can find this?
Okay. I bet
well,
you
honey,
can.
We looked, we couldn't find it.
Wow.
She also wanted to buy a Pearl Jam record, and I said, honey, that's really great. Those might be a little bit harder to find.
And a little bit more expensive.
And a little bit more expensive.
A little bit.
But we can look. So, but it's part of the things, you know, engaging her
uh-huh.
of what she wants to listen to. Like it or not, she does like Taylor Swift. So, hey.
Sure.
She also likes Florence and the Machine.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's look for those records.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to listen to those. She can sing along with them. She can identify them. But she can hold them in her hand, and she can put them on her record player and listen to them when she wants.
And it's a larger experience. It's a more tactile and engaging experience because it's this big cover art.
Yes, exactly. One of the things we make when we go to the record store, we make it as almost a scavenger hunt. We decide, let's find the most interesting album cover.
As long
and let's
as
check
not
it out.
G.G. Allen.
No, I don't think there's any G.G. Allen there, any feces being thrown. But that's one of the things that we can bond together when we go to the record store.
Sure, sure.
But it also makes it part of a game. Oh, look at this. This is really interesting. What is this going mm-hmm. on here? Should we buy it? Okay, let's go check it out.
Yeah.
But excellent. That goes into the, again, this record can be used not only to listen to, but for art as well.
Uh-huh. So jumping back as we gonna stay on course tonight. You really feel that Record Store Day, all of the hundreds of people in the line, at least a couple of them will become regular customers, you think?
For sure. And you get hooked. You get sucked into that. And then you're in that record store and you're looking under the counter where the special releases are, such as, oh, what do you have there? You have a Pearl Jam first year fan club limited edition single, a 45 there. You get to know the folks who work at the record store
yeah.
enough where they set this aside, or you come up to the counter and say, oh, hey, by the way,
yeah,
I set this aside for you. Do you want it? Yes, I do. Do I need it? No. Am I going to listen to it once or twice? That's where the fine line of, am I going to buy this to say, oh, hey, I have all X amount of year fan club singles in my arsenal here to listen to.
Sure.
Am I going to listen to them? You know what? I'm going to listen to them once or twice to say that I listened to it and to see what was so special about it. But I'm not going to. I have a hard time if I see a record that is special edition, limited edition, or whatever. I have a hard time buying something if I'm not going to listen to it. And I understand
yeah.
that it might be X amount of dollars, but I want to listen to it. And
yeah.
I don't want to just buy something to say, oh, well, I got it. And
mm-hmm.
it's so awesome.
It's the collector versus the listener, if you will.
I guess I'm in that. I'm collecting to listen.
Sure.
I'm not just collecting to collect.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like in the era when we do have something like the internet and YouTube, where, let's be honest, you can find whatever you need. If you wanted to hear that first year Pearl Jam fan club single, you can hear it without
yes.
a problem. It's
yes.
it's out there. So, you know, I don't get people completely. Like, I understand some people are completists, but I mean, the point to me, and this is just me and I'm weird. The point of owning a record is to enjoy the record. And I feel like, I said this to you the other day, that people who buy, you know, oh, I have this first pressing and it's still shrink-wrapped, check it out. I'm like, I have this really cool piece of art on my wall. It's you. They have the same purpose, except my piece of art doesn't actually contain music in it that I could listen to if I took the shrink-wrap off of it.
You might as well have that piece of artwork in your cabinet or in a tube locked up and not seeing it. It's
right.
the same thing.
Yeah.
A vintage car collector, they drive their cars to shows, they show them off, they go here and there. It's the same concept to me.
Uh-huh.
If you're a vintage car collector and that car stays in the garage and never sees the light of day, no one sees it, what's the point in having it?
Yeah.
I got a 57 Chevy and it's awesome. Well, great. Well, what are you
cool.
doing with it? Nothing.
Yeah.
Now, if there was a, I don't know, and maybe there's a special exception where there was, I'm sure there might be.
But sure, if you find some just like classic piece, you know, that has been reissued and you have an original, I totally get it.
I have one exception to the rule.
Okay.
Going back to Metallica.
Yes.
The Garage Days Revisited album signed by all four members at that time.
And it's signed on the shrink wrap.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
That is in a frame.
Yeah.
Never
yeah.
been opened.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm breaking my own rule a little bit there.
No, I understand that.
But I don't want to mess with that.
Well, it has other historical significance. You know, it's whoever got it signed, you should have just taken the shrink wrap off. So another band that you and I share a passion for and have actually seen an incarnation of live together, Guns N' Roses have certainly been in the news in 2016 quite a bit with their reunion that is only about 6 weeks away. It's supposed to happen mid-April if they can actually keep it together and make it to Coachella. You and I saw them together, was that 2007?
No, 2002.
No way, that was 2002?
Yes.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yep.
So we saw them, that was with Buckethead, right? Buckethead
Correct.
Was on that
yep.
tour.
Yep.
We saw them in Cleveland, and that was at Gund Arena, which is now Quicken Loans Arena, where yep. the Cavs play.
It was maybe 3/4 full.
I think it was less than that.
There
was nobody there. We were on the floor.
Yep.
We're
about halfway back.
Who opened that show?
Beastie Boys.
Mixmaster Mike.
Yes.
Yeah. So we saw Guns N' Roses, and I also saw Guns N' Roses 10 years earlier than that, as you know. I saw them when they toured with Metallica and Faith No More.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah, I got my dad was cool enough to drop me off at Blossom, the amphitheater here in Cleveland. And he's like, okay, I'll pick you up, you know, just call home when it's over.
Wait, how did you call home?
Payphone?
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, remember the 90s?
Sorry, we're dating ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, but I loved it and I had a great time, but I still feel like at the age I was then, I could have appreciated it more if I was a few years older, of course.
Mm-hmm,
but
of course.
I remember when we saw Guns N' Roses in, oh my God, that was 2002. It wasn't a bad show.
It was entertaining. I think, and I understand why Axl enlisted Buckethead's...
Dude can play.
He can play, and he has that mystique, if you will.
He's got a bucket on his head.
He wears a mask, and so he has that kind of mysterious, if you will. Not that Slash is mysterious.
I mean, it's not quite Slash's hat, but, you know, I mean, it's a KFC bucket.
Exactly. And it's long, black, curly hair, like
right.
Slash.
No Les Paul.
No, not at all. But I think he was trying to go for someone to replace Slash, not only in terms of skill, but that, you know, that kind of, not character that Slash is, mm-hmm. but what he, you know, everyone has their own persona. You have Axl, you have Slash.
Right,
you have...
It wasn't some other guitarist playing Slash's leads. It was Buckethead.
Right.
It was a name.
Right. And I actually watched them when they were at the house, no, I'm sorry, what's in Las Vegas at the Joint.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them play on TV a performance there. And I'm watching that and I'm just like saying to myself, what is going on?
Yeah.
He was trying too hard, number one. And again, me and you and I have always talked about this. And I think a lot of other folks who listen to this and who are music lovers can agree. If you really love that band, you can be critical of them because you
sure.
love them, not just because you're trying to pick them apart or whatnot. But when I saw them perform, and Axl was trying to sing November Rain,
yeah.
and he couldn't yeah. hit the parts anymore.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying that he shouldn't try, but let's lower the
what Robert Plant did when Zeppelin did the reunion a couple years back. He brought down the octaves because he
yes.
knew. He can't hit the notes he was hitting in 71.
Right, exactly. But no, the cast of characters that he had on stage, you know, again, were they playing the songs? Yes, they
yeah.
sounded great.
Yep.
But it just was not the same.
Right, it's why the Doors realized we can't be a band anymore because we lost frickin' Jim.
And even though who they bring in, like Ian Astbury from The Cult, I mean, thank you, great, but no thanks.
But you're not Jim Morrison.
No. But I don't understand, and again, going back to the, you have all these cast of characters in there, mm-hmm. and I guess it's a little bit different because they're not writing any new music right now. And the stuff and the music that I fell in love with from Guns N' Roses was not the Chinese Democracy.
Right.
Sorry.
Right. Yeah. Nobody fell in love with that album except Axl.
I tried to listen to it, and
we all did. I think anyone who is really a Guns N' Roses fan, you know, whether you're like, oh man, I only listen to Appetite, or like you understand the genius that is Use Your Illusion 1 or 2, or you know what, you find the humor in the spaghetti incident.
Some of those songs, not to
forget Lies either. Let's
right.
You know.
Some of those songs on the spaghetti incident were really I didn't realize because they had songs from the UK subs, they had songs from the Damned there, and you. That made me appreciate Guns N' Roses even more because I realized they had like a Misfits song on there too, but it really made me realize that these guys really had deep, well-rounded musical taste.
Very much so. Yeah, I think everyone wanted to like Chinese Democracy. Like the joke that it took so long, whatever it was, the joke. But you're like, I'm just hoping it's going to be something monumental, and it just
some
wasn't.
Of the songs. Some of the songs were okay.
I'll give you okay on
we're
some
okay.
of them. Okay on some of them.
But
fine.
Some of them.
Fine.
Axl was trying too hard.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
The whole thing about this reunion is.
Where's Izzy? That's the whole thing about this reunion.
Because.
Where the hell is Izzy?
Right. And you and I were both one of those music fans where, again, record or. What do they call them? Cassette tapes?
Yeah, I remember
when
those things.
When I got a cassette tape, I would open it up. And when I got a new album, record, cassette, or CD, I would open it up and I would read the liner notes.
I would read
the lyrics.
Notes. Yep.
I would read.
See who they're thanking.
Well, I would read who played what
and
who wrote the songs.
That's how I remember. That's how I found out that Shannon Hoon from Blind Melon was doing backing vocals on Estranged.
Right.
On
and I didn't understand why this. Yeah, exactly.
Shannon Hoon?
But if you go back and you look at those, who was one of the primary songwriters in Appetite and Use Your Illusions.
Izzy
was in there.
Goddamn Stradlin.
Yeah. And he was one of those, maybe unsung hero is not the...
Yeah, no, most people forget, most people don't know how much of the process Izzy was responsible for.
But, you know, I could buy a quote-unquote reunion, at least if Gilby was there. He was part of the, of the Use Your Illusion tours.
Absolutely.
I could buy that. You know, and Dizzy has been with Axl. He's been a lawyer, a loyal
soldier.
Sure,
he's been there the whole time.
You know, okay, he's coming back, great. And if Izzy didn't want to do this, I can understand why, because of all the turmoil and because of everything that, all the baggage that has come so far. Have Slash and Axl really made up?
No.
You know what? I'd be curious
I don't think
to see
made up.
How much.
I think they've forgotten. They were probably just like, this is like 20 years old, whatever it was. Just doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
Because I'm guessing it wasn't like what broke, you know, the issues that we saw between Black Sabbath and Bill Ward, where it was clearly about money.
Right.
You know, I doubt, with the amount of money the Guns N' Roses machine was making at that time, I can't think that the breakup was over money.
But to your original point about, is this really a reunion? I mean, I guess it's as close as it's going
to
be.
Do you think they're actually going to make it to the Coachella shows?
You know what? I think they're going to make it to the Coachella show. I think they're going to come on about an hour late.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're going to play. And then I think the fire will start there. And I think that they'll make it a few shows. Uh-huh. I'm saying they're going to make it five shows.
You're saying five shows. I'm saying one post-Coachella show. Like they will do Coachella both weekends. They will get one show and then it'll
They're
implode.
Playing both weekends?
Yeah, they're playing both weekends.
Oh, wow.
Do you think the shows will be good?
That's a...
Because here's my problem here. It's not a problem. It's a concern. And this is my concern whenever a band comes back after a very long time. And that includes the fact of how excited I am to see Belly reform after 20 years this August. Is that band has aged. They are not, you know, Guns N' Roses are not the whiskey drinking, groupie banging, you know, late 20, early 30 year olds that they once were. They're dads and they're old men now.
And I think most of them are sober.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that that's like,
right,
bad.
We're not, but you know what? And I made this exact comparison. I said, I hate to be a dick, but the Red Hot Chili Peppers made much better music when they were wasted. They just did.
Yeah, no arguments.
And part of the amazement of Guns N' Roses was that this whiskey-fueled chaos train somehow made it to stage within a few hours of when they were supposed to every night and blew the fucking roof off every night because they were so good.
Right.
I'm just so worried for people who are invested so heavily in this, not just financially, that Guns N' Roses are going to go out there and they're going to play the songs. And you know what? The songs might sound good, but to use a word you used, that fire will be very obviously missing.
So take that back to any other bands. Let's take it to Metallica.
Okay.
I think most of them are clean and sober. Obviously, the Some Kind of Monster brought all that stuff out.
Yeah.
Do you think that bands need to have that original, whatever it is, whether drugs or alcohol or living on the streets or having a hard life, whatever it is that necessary to keep the performance level where it is or was and just continue to write the music that originally started their movement or what brought them their success?
If they're trying to make that same sound, yes, it does matter. You know, I mean, if you look at a band, if the band has evolved, this covers Metallica, but the band I'm actually thinking of is REM, who, you know, played for 30 years and developed their sound over that time and changed their sound, but it was all at the core kind of the same. You listen to the really early stuff, it's a lot more rock and roll. You can hear the punk rock influences, and by the time they get to the end, which I didn't really like, let's just stop it at like 1999, it's much more melodic. You know, it's just gorgeous music and all this. And I still see them as the same band. The same way that Metallica, as much as I don't like the post-Newsted era, it's still Metallica because they're continuing to evolve as a band. My issue here is Guns N' Roses haven't been on stage together or really in any large
since
incarnation.
93?
Yeah. I believe 93 was the end of it. That's,
oh my God.
That's a really long time to be just away from it and to be the monster that they, I feel, need to be to deliver on the promise. It's a lot. I mean, even, you know, when Zeppelin did it, and obviously Zeppelin was missing what to me is the most important part of that band, obviously with John Bonham. When Zeppelin did the O2 Arena shows, I think everybody knew what they were going to get. They were going to get the greatest hits one night and whatever. It was all about the nostalgia. Everybody knew what it was. This was a nostalgia show. People have real, and this is not a slam on Zeppelin because I love that band to death. People have real expectations of Guns N' Roses to come out there and kick everybody's teeth in.
I'm with you. I'm very skeptical about if that energy level is going to be able to be there. Prove me wrong, guys.
I hope I'm wrong.
Prove me wrong.
Happily wrong. I suppose we'll have to wait and see what happens.
I have high expectations. I'm not going there. I just hope, as them being one of my all-time favorite bands / being one of my all-time favorite guitarists, that they can pull it off. I hope they can for them.
I have high expectations and low hope. My thanks again to Christian for what is always solid, insightful conversation on music. He always makes me think, and hey, you know what? He's put up with me for a very, very long time. You can go follow him on Twitter at CASCBUS, and you can yell at him about things if you want. Tell him I said it was okay. Before we call it an episode, though, I do, of course, have your Ear Fuel homework assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, every single episode, I suggest a single album for you to listen to, beginning to end without any interruptions or distractions. It comes from the idea that these days, music has become a background task for most people. You're driving, you're at the gym, you're at work, whatever. And this is all about consciously listening to music for the sake of the music. This week, since Christian and I flew down to Memphis, Tennessee to see them play one live show, your Earfuel homework assignment is the self-titled debut album from Grinderman. This is a Nick Cave side project that's basically him and three bad seeds, Warren, Martin, and Jim, and it's absolutely one of the most awesome pieces of hard rock majesty ever recorded. What you had here was Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds had just finished the Lyre of Orpheus tour, and Nick decided to start messing around with an electric guitar, which he doesn't do often. He realized that the songs were more unpolished and raw, so he pulled those three specifically into the studio to kind of see what happened. There's just this power, this unrestrained force that comes through in every song on this album, and yet in the same moment that they want to destroy your speakers, you get a strong groove and melody, because you just can't forget for a second how much musical talent is in the people on this album. Think about it. You've got an exceptionally talented, well-seasoned rock band basically deciding to do a punk-style record. Not punk in the idea of not really caring or being really brief and not playing much, but punk in spirit. I just can't express how awesome the Sonic Assault is here. Not in a crushing heavy metal sort of way, in a, my God, the sound is so massive but beautiful, that sort of way. This is what rock and roll is about. It's got great hooks, wild guitar, and plenty of attitude. And the entire time, they're sitting right on the edge of chaos. And that creates this tension. You can feel it. It's so good. It's palpable. Oh, I love this record. You have furious rock perfection on songs like Honey Bee Let's Fly to Mars and Love Bomb and the brilliantly unsubtle No Pussy Blues. But there are also quieter, gorgeous tracks like Go Tell the Women. You've got the title track. They really touch all the bases here. Maybe the best way to express my love for this album is to say this. This is true. Back in 2010, when they were touring off of the second record, which is creatively called Grinder Man 2, which is also worth checking out, they hadn't announced any U.S. shows. So I decided, even though I didn't have a ticket and I knew nobody there, I was going to fly to Brussels, Belgium, on the off chance I might be able to get one on the street. I put all of that time, effort, and money, maybe I'll actually get one there. Now, even after they announced the U.S. shows, I still flew to Brussels without a ticket, and I ended up getting one, and it was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And yes, after seeing them in Brussels, I flew to two other U.S. cities just to see them. They are that good. This record is just one of those extraordinary musical moments that not enough people know about, so do your ears a favor and get on the Grinder Man train as soon as possible. So that's all for this episode. As always, you can follow me on Twitter at TheDailyGuru and at GetEarFuel. And the show is in the iTunes store under EarFuel and at SoundCloud.com/GetEarFuel. And hey, if you dug it, go tell a friend or three. That is your EarFuel for this time. Share and enjoy.